This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. The high-risk covert missions undertaken by American elite special forces in recent military conflicts have been well documented in books, movies, and articles. But the idea of a small group of highly trained operators engaging in secretive warfare behind enemy lines actually reaches back 75 years to the formation of Britain's Special Air Service, the SAS. In a new book, Rogue Heroes, The Secret History of the SAS, author Ben McIntyre traces the unlikely origins, colorful characters, and unconventional warfare of this group in Europe and North Africa during World War II. Its battle-tested legacy is reflected in the tactics and strategies employed by special forces today. Today on The Exchange, the history of the British Special Air Service. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And joining us from London is Ben McIntyre. He's author of Rogue Heroes, The History of the SAS, Britain's special Forces Unit that Sabotaged the Nazis and Changed the Nature of War. He also writes for the Times of London and has made documentaries of his work for the BBC. And Ben, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
You've written several books and, as I mentioned, made documentaries. But how did you come up with the idea for this particular project, Rogue Heroes?
Well, in truth, Dean, I didn't come up with this idea. This idea actually came from the SAS itself, the Special Air Service. To understand what that means, you have to know that the SAS is probably, after MI5 and MI6, the most secretive organisation in Britain. Although you could probably put the Royal Family in there too, but the SAS does not tell its story. That is part of its kind of mystery. It's part of its mystique. And for 75 years, the archives of the SAS have been completely sealed. No historian has been allowed access to them. But I was contacted about nearly 4 years ago now by a publisher who had made an arrangement with the SAS to allow a single historian access to the SAS archives, which meant that the story of this extraordinary special forces unit could really be told in full for the first time. So the story, in a way, came to me. I didn't dig it out.
That's very interesting. And so they, because of your previous work on this, they came to you, or how did you make that connection?
Well, I'm not even sure quite why they selected me. They may be regretting it by now. You never know. I mean, they may have wished they didn't. But I think what they really wanted, or at least what they said they wanted, was the way they described it was a warts and all biography. They wanted someone to come in to write a narrative history rather than a kind of what you might call a rather more straightforward regimental history. I mean, I would not be equipped to write such a thing. I'm not a military historian. I'm a narrative historian, and I try to write in a way that gives the story pace and sort of drama without ever falsifying the facts, obviously. But it's not, I am not a sort of scholarly military historian, and I think that's what they wanted.
Yeah, and I notice in the book you mentioned that you sort of go out of your way to make this suitable for a general audience. Yeah, I found when I read the book, other than Googling the occasional German aircraft or machine gun type, it generally was pretty easy to follow kind of the military activity.
Well, I'm delighted to hear you say that, Dean, because I did not want to write a book that was about military manoeuvres and, you know, which unit was where and who won what medal, because in truth, that's not really the kind of history that interests me particularly. I'm much more interested in character and personality. And in terms of the SAS, what particular facets of character and behaviour were required for this, at the time, extraordinary form of warfare? I mean, one has to realise that this kind of behind-the-lines action that we now regard as absolutely commonplace. Indeed, it is, you know, arguably it's the most important form of warfare these days. We can discuss that later. But it was absolutely revolutionary at the time, particularly in the British Army. And the reason for that, I think, is that many staff officers in 1941, when the SAS was founded, had seen military action during the First World War. And so they had a very static, rather traditionalist view of how war ought to be fought. Mm-hmm. And that was that two enormous armies would meet on a battlefield, in the case of the First World War, with trenches, you know, dug to delineate the front line. And then they would simply duke it out until one side won. Well, what the SAS did was come up with a completely different and very radical approach, which was simply to ignore the front line and go round it.
We're talking with author Ben McIntyre today about his new book, Rogue Heroes, The History of the SAS, Britain's Secret Special Forces Unit. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. It's a great opportunity to ask questions about World War II and in particular the British role in it. Ben, talk a little bit about some of the unique access you had to archival material. You mention in the book, in particular, something called the SAS War Diary, which seems to be a sort of a top secret chronicle of what the unit did.
Well, I mean, to describe the SAS archive, indeed, as an archive is very slightly misleading, because although it does contain a huge number of documents, most of them top secret, most of them relating to particular actions, it contains a whole lot of other stuff as well. Diaries, letters, postcards, memoirs, poems, helmets, parachutes, maps. It is absolutely stuffed with artifacts. And one of the reasons, it's sort of in a way more a museum than it is an archive, but it's a secret one. Because one of the things that, you know, wartime SAS veterans did as they were reaching the end of their lives, they simply tended to bundle everything up that they had, every letter, every photograph, everything, and they just put it in boxes and hand it back to the regiment. And that stuff has simply lain unread for 75 years in some cases. And there's a peculiar thrill for any historian in opening a letter that has probably not been read since the time it was first opened. That's a very strange feeling. And as you said, I mean, one of the key sort of really, in fact, the key artifact in this whole archive, which is kept in a secret location. I can't tell your listeners where it actually is, but it's in Britain. That'll give you an idea. But it's it is this war diary, which was secretly compiled at the end of the war by one of the SAS intelligence officers. And it's really a kind of scrapbook, really. It contains all sorts of little bits and pieces, all of them completely secret, that this one intelligence officer decided told the story of the regiment. And he put them all into a kind of leather-bound book. Now, the book itself had an extraordinary history because it's this leather-bound tome. It's a huge, great thing, which was, in fact, liberated from a Nazi office in 1945 by the SAS. So it has sort of embossed swastikas on it because it was actually intended to be something of use by, I suspect, a sort of local Nazi town hall. I'm not quite sure exactly where it came from. So the thing itself is a kind of museum piece, and it's tremendously detailed. It's got all sorts of stuff in it. And it simply remained hidden for 75 years. It was kept inside the archive, and nobody, and I mean nobody, was allowed to read it.
So I'm curious, as someone who's done research on American presidents, and there are often hoops I have to jump through to get at classified material, it sounds like they just opened the doors to you, or were there very sort of specific protocols and processes that you had to go through in order to do this writing and research?
Well, the doors were opened, but I mean the doors were pretty heavily guarded. You know, the SAS doesn't allow you in very easily, but we got a sort of system going there. The only strictures, the only constraints that were put on me were that I was not to write about modern SAS operations. In other words, I was allowed to write up until the end of the war, but really no further, because the SAS, like Delta Force, like all special forces, keeps its operational secrets very close. And the last thing they wanted me to do was to start digging into the later history. And that seemed to me to be a perfectly reasonable requirement. I was concerned when I first took on the project that they might try to oversee it a little too closely, that they might there might be elements in the story that they would want to suppress. But I found, actually, on the contrary, I mean, there are elements of this story that do not redound to the credit of the SAS. Indeed, there are many of them. I mean, sometimes, as in all wars, terrible things happen. But so far from trying to prevent me from writing about those, the SAS seemed to be perfectly happy to see them published.
So here in the U.S., we have a lot of books and movies. People like reading about the Navy SEALs, Delta Force, other special operations units. As you mentioned, we've actually had some issues with books by former Navy SEALs about what they can and cannot reveal. Is there a similar interest in this kind of military culture in Great Britain? And just generally, how well known was SAS history in Britain before you wrote this book?
I think it's fair to say that there is no institution or organization in Britain that carries more mystique than the SAS. People are absolutely obsessed by it in this country. It has a kind of a grip on the sort of popular, I have to say, mostly male imagination that is quite unlike anything else. I mean, there are something like three or four different television programs running at the moment that are about the SAS, and a lot of those focus very closely on the sort of physical stamina required to be in the SAS, the sort of physical training, the elements of kind of mental toughness that go into joining, because it's a very elite unit. I mean, as the SEALs, as Delta Force are, you know, to get into the SAS from the regular army is an enormous hill to climb. And I think one of the things that sort of attracts the popular imagination is the question of whether, you know, how one would oneself measure up to those kind of challenges and so on.
Sure. Do you have any recent former members writing books? You know, as I mentioned, we've had a number of fairly recent retired Navy SEALs writing books talking about various operations and things of that nature.
There are many. I mean, one of the things that happens is that people leave the SAS, and then in some cases they write about their experiences. Now, those people are uniformly repudiated by the SAS itself. There is a very strong culture in the SAS, as I understand there is in Delta Force and SEALs as well, that you do not write about, you do not reveal what you have done. Now, if you break that unwritten and largely unspoken rule, you are likely to be shunned by the SAS. And that is really what has happened to a lot of the people who have decided to break cover and reveal what they've done.
Yeah, it sounds like some of the similar controversies we've had here with books from some formal operators about whether or not you break this code of silence. We're talking with Ben McIntyre. He's author of Rogue Heroes, The History of the SAS, Britain's Secret Special Forces. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@NHPR, and I'll get it here in the studio. Let us know your questions about World War II and Special Forces. Ben, let's talk a little bit about the origins of this unit itself. From reading the book, it sounds like there were commando forces prior to the SAS. Can you say a little bit about the difference between the sort of these commandos that you reference and then the actual SAS unit?
Well, the SAS grew out of the commandos almost exclusively. I mean, it started as a sort of subunit of the commandos. Now, the commandos were designed, actually they were modelled by Churchill on the German model as kind of shock troops. These were to be highly trained combat troops who would be sent in to pick out and pick off specific high value targets. They weren't intended to be a behind-the-lines operation. They were quite numerous, in fact. I mean, there were, I think, something like 3,000 or 4,000 commandos sent to the Middle East, the idea being that they would attack bridges, they would attack beachheads, they would attack various specific targets. But in fact, they weren't very well used, and indeed they were little used. The commandos that arrived, the British commandos that arrived in the Middle East, and many of them felt that they were underused. That really they should have been used for more delicate and more detailed operations. I mean, one of the problems with the commandos was that if you send 400 commandos in to attack a beach and to take, as it were, a kind of radar station on the beach, they're going to see you coming.
Right.
I mean, one of the problems with that is that no matter, you know, once you're that size of force, it's very, very hard to disguise yourself. And that, in a way, is the central element of what emerged as the SAS, was the belief that you could have smaller units and do very different things.
And you have this personality that you introduce us to David Sterling, who's the founder. And from the story, I guess he's injured in a commando raid. And as he's recuperating, he has this idea. Say a little bit about kind of what he was thinking about here, kind of the sort of character and personality that made this idea appealing. You know, you get a sense from some of the initial members of the unit that it's sort of a kind of an eccentric group of fairly young, loners. And he generally had this belief that if they just left him alone, he could actually be more useful.
I mean, eccentric is quite a generous description of what the early SAS were. I mean, there's a rather good, rather archaic British word. Bonkers is probably closer. I mean, David Sterling was wildly eccentric. I mean, he was a very strange and interesting man. He was 6'4". He was very aristocratic. He was not very fit. He smoked and drank an enormous amount. But he was the founder of this, what would become a famously elite, incredibly tough combat unit. And the way that the SAS came into being is worth recalling, really. And I didn't really believe this story when I first set out on this project. I'd heard it in the sort of mythology of the SAS, but it seemed to me to be extremely unlikely. But actually, every word of it is true. I mean, what happened to Sterling was that he was bored to death, really. I mean, he was in the commandos and he was sitting in Cairo waiting for the action that he'd been promised, and it simply wasn't happening. So he happened to come across a bunch of unused parachutes. That was the way he described it. Unused is again a slight euphemism. In fact, he simply stole them. He found them on a dock in Suez and just lifted them and took them off and decided that he would try a bit of parachuting. Now, he'd never done any parachuting. He had absolutely zero training in parachuting. And so his first parachute jump involved getting into an entirely inappropriate sort of plane, persuading the pilot to take him up above the desert, above the Egyptian desert, and then simply tying the ripcord to a chair leg inside the plane.
So it'll pop the chute.
Hopping and then opening the door and jumping out. Now, what happened was that because it was the wrong sort of plane, it was a Valencia, it was the wrong shape for parachuting. As he leapt out and the parachute filled, it snagged on the tail fin of the plane, which could have brought the plane down too.
Sure.
But in fact, it tore a couple of panels out of the parachute, which meant that Sterling, didn't so much drift to earth as plummet. And he came down at roughly four times the recommended speed, hit the ground and severely damaged his back. I mean, really badly damaged his back. In fact, he never fully recovered from it. But it was while recuperating from that accident in a Cairo hospital that Sterling began to think more deeply about what possible uses parachuting could be put to in the wider war. And he began to speculate that if you could train up a group of parachutists, you could use them to drop them deep into the Libyan desert. Now, the use of this would be that because the German and Italian airfields were strung out all across the Libyan coast, they were in a way far behind the front line.
Right.
And those airfields were actually vital for what was going on in the war at that point.
So the idea here is we've got this North African theater, and you've got sort of British forces, I think, to the east, and Rommel, the German in the west, kind of going back and forth along the coast. And so the concept was to drop a small unit well in behind enemy lines and basically have them create chaos, blow up oil depots and runways and planes and things of that nature.
That's exactly it. I mean, it's a little schematic to put it this way, but if you like to think of North Africa as a kind of semicircle, sort of, as it were, going west to east, the front line was moving sort of back and forth on the right-hand side of that, sort of, west of Cairo.
Right.
But beyond that was 500 miles of pretty much empty desert, and that was where Sterling saw the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. We do need to take a quick break, but coming up, much more on how this eccentric group became the SAS. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The Poet Eva Kruschill writes in her most recent collection about the history of American immigration.
And I think it's funny that history repeats itself, and that as soon as we get legalized, we tend to distance ourselves from those people who are not legalized yet, but they have something to tell us.
This week on The Bookshelf from NHPR, Eva Kruschill on poetry and immigration. Subscribe to The Bookshelf from NHPR wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, author Ben McIntyre in his book on the origins of the British Secret Special Forces Unit, the SAS. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Ben, before the break, we were talking about this North African theater of operations and some of the major cities in there. You know, there's Tripoli and Cairo and, interestingly enough, Benghazi that they were fighting over. We had an email from John, and John would like to ask about the SAS desert rats in the Sahara 42 to 43. He says they worked behind enemy lines and harassed Rommel's Africa Corps early in the war. He said there was a TV show called Rat Patrol in the early 70s. I think I remember that, based on their activity. So the SAS desert rats.
Well, those desert rats are precisely the origins of the modern day SAS. And your listener is exactly right. I mean, what they did, what their job really was to create havoc. They were there to harass Rommel in the sort of rear areas in any way they could. And that involved primarily blowing up aircraft, because the aircraft were absolutely vital to what was going on in the Mediterranean at that point. Germany and Italy had air supremacy. We forget that now because it's a distant part of the war. But actually, they controlled the skies, which meant that they could make life very, very difficult for Allied shipping, specifically for Malta, for British-held Malta. And the convoys going to and from Malta were being very heavily battered by the German and Italian air forces based in North Africa. So anything that Stirling and his men could do to degrade that capacity was going to have a direct military effect. But beyond that, there was a kind of psychological impact that was very important, because one has to bear in mind that the war was going very, very badly for Britain at this point in 1941. I mean, we were losing the war. It was going wrong. And what was needed, Churchill decided, was a kind of psychological boost. And in a way, that's really the most powerful thing that the SAS did, was both to demoralize Germany and Italy, because the German and Italian forces based on the coast thought they were safe from attack. They believed they were far behind the lines. In fact, what happened was they would wake up in the middle of the night to find that their aircraft were all in flames.
Right.
And so the effect of that on demoralizing the enemy was very important.
But, well, it's interesting. Mm. You know, you mentioned blowing up planes, and one of the themes that came out of the book for me really is the importance, even way back then, of technological innovation. And my recollection was that they actually develop the explosives that you can actually stick on these planes to blow them up. And also, their mission is really revolutionized by the introduction of the Jeep, which I thought was fascinating as well. So say a little bit about kind of the importance of, even back then, of technological change.
Well, absolutely. I mean, to us, the technology might today seem rather rustic and straightforward, but at the time it was quite revolutionary. I mean, they had to work out a way of being able to carry high explosives over long distances in such a way that these could then be attached to aeroplanes in the middle of the night on a delayed time switch and then blow up, giving the attackers time to get back into the desert and escape. So, I mean, it sounds like a simple thing to do. It actually was extremely difficult to do. At that point, they were reliant on things called time pencils, which were small glass fuses, effectively, that you would break. And the acid therein would slowly work its way through a length of wire. And once that wire was eaten through by the acid, it would ping, and the bomb would go off. Well, as you can tell, that's a pretty unsophisticated sort of timing device. But, you know, different lengths of wire and different widths of wire were used to give different, effectively, time bombs. But the SAS invented a thing called a Lewis bomb, named after the inventor, a man called Jock Lewis, which was really a kind of combination of high explosive, thermite, and diesel oil. which they packed together in what they used to call black puddings, which were these sort of lumps of about a kilo or a kilo and a half each, which would then be wrapped in canvas. And each man, it was thought, could carry up to 30 of these Lewis bombs, which were, you know, light enough to be able to carry. And what they would then do is literally to sneak onto the airfields at night, cut through the wire. Often they were, at the beginning of the war, at the beginning of this period, they were quite lightly defended, the airfields. They would climb on, attach these Lewis bombs secretly by sticking them usually to the underside of the right wings or the left wings of the plane, because they worked out that, of course, that if you only blow the right, if you blow either wing off, then you give the opportunity to replace them, whereas if you blow off only the right-hand wings, they have to get a whole lot of right-hand wings in. So, I mean, it sounds, again, very sort of straightforward, but actually it was anything but, and it was incredibly dangerous because these things had a tendency to go off in your hand. So quite a few of the casualties were from that. But you mentioned the other key piece of technology, which, of course, came from America. Yep, the arrival of the Willis Jeep and the Bantam Jeeps absolutely transformed the war in the desert, because these little jeeps were tough as blazes. I've driven some, actually. I mean, they're remarkable things, and they hold the desert floor really very, very well. I mean, they're not complicated pieces of machinery by modern standards, but they're rugged and they're tough and they're versatile. And Stirling worked out that you could actually mount anti-aircraft guns on them, both fore and aft. I mean, some of these little jeeps had two anti-aircraft guns at the front and one at the back.
Yeah, pictures in the book. It's pretty remarkable looking.
They're incredible things. And if you fire a Vickers twin aircraft an anti-aircraft gun from the front of a little Jeep like that, the Jeep starts leaping around like a kind of like a stung cat.
Wait, right.
Yeah, it just sort of bounces all over the place. But he worked out this was another way that they would destroy airfields. They would simply drive onto the airfields in formation with these heavily armed Jeeps and drive down a line of parked aircraft and simply open up with these anti-aircraft guns at pretty much a point-blank range, right, and just simply blow them to shreds.
Yeah, so I'm a proud owner of a modern Jeep Wrangler, not weaponized. And it is quite primitive, but you literally feel like you could drive up the side of a building sometimes. Off-road capabilities are amazing.
Get it weaponized, Dino. Why not?
I mean, I think that would get me in a little trouble here.
Well, yes, I suppose it probably would in New Hampshire. You're right. I mean, those things absolutely made a huge difference. And because, you know, once America had joined the war, they were available in really huge numbers and quite cheap to make, quite cheap to manufacture. I mean, and when you think of the distances that Stirling and his men were having to cover, these little jeeps were extraordinarily useful. Some of them would simply be laden up with gas, with petrol, and they would drive out into the desert and just abandon them as they used up the petrol. That was how far they had to go.
Let's go to the phones. We have Ray joining us from Londonderry. Ray, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. I was find it fascinating. I was never in the Special Forces, but as provided intelligence support to them. But my question is somewhat specific. I hope the author knows what I'm talking about. But there was, I don't recall the name, a rather well-known in later life, but SAS actually had a chaplain and had a rough group like David Stirling and Paddy Main, but I think he seemed to get along well with such a crowd. I was wondering if Mr. McIntyre has any knowledge of this.
Yes,
I do indeed.
Thank you,
yeah.
Ray. Yes, you mentioned in the book he joins the unit at some point.
Absolutely. The man you're referring to is an extraordinary individual called Fraser McCluskey, who was a Scottish Presbyterian padre. He was the first padre with the SAS, and he was known as the Parachute Padre because he went on every single one of the missions in occupied Europe that the SAS carried out. He was absolutely at the spearhead of it. And he was a most remarkable man, actually, because he never carried a gun. He debated long and hard with himself whether he should and whether he could and the ethics of it. And even that element of his story alone is well worth reading, because you realise you're dealing with a man who has a very strong conscience, who realizes that he absolutely has to take part in this war, but cannot himself shed blood and would not shed blood. And he never carried a gun right to the end. And he was with the SAS all the way through. I commend his book to you. It's called it's called the Parachute Padre, which sounds a little self-inflating, but in fact he was a man of most humble attitudes. And interestingly, Fraser McCluskey was one of the very few people in the SAS who had actually seen Nazi Germany at first hand. He was married to a German woman, and he had travelled extensively in pre-war Germany, and he had watched, in fact he lived there for a couple of years, and so he had watched at close quarters the rise of the Third Reich and realised the evil that the Allies were fighting. So he had in a way a sort of personal crusade going there. I mean, his story in some ways is absolutely tragic, because at the end of the war he went in search of his wife's family, who had been in Dresden, and discovered that they had in fact been killed, all of them, in some of the last bombing raids of the war. So for him, it was a very personal war.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ray, for that call. David emailed us, and he mentions the Long Range Desert Group, which you mentioned in the book Partners early on with the SAS, Popsky's Private Army, and he also says fuel was Romney's Achilles heel.
Yes, absolutely. Rommel's Achilles heel.
That is Rommel, yes.
That is exactly Rommel. Right. No, it's probably Romney's as well. But it's yes, I mean, the LRDG, the Long Range Desert Group, was really the precursor unit in some ways to the SAS. The Long Range Desert Group was, and this takes us back to Ray's question earlier, the Long Range Desert Group was really an intelligence gathering unit that had worked out ways to traverse this vast Libyan desert, to creep up on the airfields and the roads, actually the single coastal road running along the coast of North Africa, and essentially sort of gather information on troop movements and troop strengths and so on, and then bring them back. So they were, as Ray was, an intelligence unit. But what Stirling worked out was that, I mean, Stirling's first attempt at a raid was a catastrophic disaster, in fact. It was called Operation Squatter, and it involved parachuting something like 55 men into the desert. Well, it didn't work out very well, because they jumped in the teeth of a gale, and more than half of them never came back. But what that convinced Stirling of was the need to actually go in and out by vehicle. And that's what the Long Range Desert Group could do. They had pioneered techniques of navigation across the desert that made them absolutely invaluable to the early SAS, because they could ferry them in to carry out these attacks, and they could ferry them out again. Mm-hmm. And that's what they did. I mean, they became referred to by Stirling and his men as the Libyan taxi service.
We have one more email from Matthew, kind of a definitional email, and he writes, I listened just yesterday to an interview with Eric Newby on BBC Desert Island Discs, and he talked about his service in World War II in the special boat service in and around Italy, and you mentioned this in the book. Is this a different service, and does it still exist?
The answer is, it is now a different service. It does still exist, but it did grow organically with the SAS. The early SAS is an SBS, Special Boat Service, is a slightly complicated story, because they are, in a way, two branches of the same operation. It began as the SAS. It then split off into two units. It then recombined again towards the end of the war as one unit, and then finally split off again. So they are intertwined. My own book is really much more about the Special Air Service, the sort of land-based operations. The Special Boat Service, however, was an extraordinarily valiant group, and they, as the name implies, operated in a marine environment. They were launching raids and attacks and special forces operations against coastal targets, really, and indeed sea targets. And so they were absolutely versed in sort of navigation, sea navigation and so on. But they are a different unit. And Eric Newby, the wonderful Eric Newby, whose travel writings I commend to all your listeners, was in the Special Boat Service.
We're talking with Ben McIntyre. He's author of Rogue Heroes, The Secret History of the SAS, Britain's Secret Special Forces Unit. You can call into the conversation at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, and I'll get that here in the studio. Ben, as I was reading the book, a couple, particularly the first part of the book on the North African theater with Rommel, as we mentioned, and then you move on to talk about Italy and France and Germany. A couple sort of themes, I think, that are still relevant today for special operations. The first is the importance and or difficulty of working with local populations on the ground. A lot of the narrative revolves around, you know, who you run into and who to trust and who double crosses you. The need to deal with local populations.
Well, I mean, that is a very important theme of this story because, of course, in the first half of the story, when they are in the North African desert, there are very few people, by definition, in the North African desert. And so running into civilians was really not a problem, which gave that war a particularly gentlemanly feel in some ways, because it was soldier fighting soldier. There were a set of rules. Prisoners were taken, prisoners were exchanged. You know, the story in a way ran on rather traditional lines, even though they were doing a different sort of warfare. Soldiers treated each other with respect. As the story develops and as the SAS goes in first into Italy and then into occupied France and then into Germany, it becomes darker and darker and darker. And the SAS find themselves dealing with partisans, with collaborators, with civilians, with women, with children. And the whole story becomes much, much darker because they don't know who to trust. They don't know. They're dealing with kind of very, very fissile and unreliable human material. And it's not like just planting bombs on planes and then running back into the desert. And a certain moral confusion does evolve. I mean, some pretty terrible things happened. When you can't trust the local villagers or the villagers don't trust you, you're fighting a very different sort of war. And I found writing the book, in some ways it was rather poignant, really, but the whole tone of it changes from what feels like a sort of boy's own paper adventure into something much darker and much dirtier.
Well, and you talk in the book about this idea of a code of conduct. Late in the war, you note that Hitler gives this order to immediately execute anyone caught. And some of the German soldiers seem really troubled by that, it's not the normal procedures, and they seem unhappy about the order.
Well, you're referring to the infamous commando order that Hitler issued. And now the commando order was issued in direct retaliation against the SAS. And it simply gave the order that any parachutist found behind the lines, and they didn't even have to be parachutists, they could have come in by boat or any other way, anyone operating behind the lines was to be summarily executed without trial. Now, that's against the Geneva Convention, mm-hmm. not that Hitler cared, but that did certainly trouble some of the German commanders. It certainly didn't trouble the SS, who were only too happy to put into operation the commando order, and scores, indeed hundreds of captured SAS soldiers were simply murdered as soon as they were captured. And you would expect this to have a consequent, and it did have an effect on the SAS. I mean, they all became aware of the commando order. They all knew that they were parachuting in. They all knew that if they were captured, they faced probable, if not certain, death at the hands of the executioners. It didn't stop many of them from going, but it did harden some of them. And there are incidents in which captured German prisoners simply were, quotes, killed while trying mm-hmm. to escape. You can interpret that how you like. There were less of those sort of brutal incidents than I expected. I thought there would be many, many more. And there's one particular incident which I'll just quickly mention, which is the liberation of Belsen, the concentration camp.
Right, you describe that in detail in the book, yeah.
I mean, there is a moment that the SAS were the first people into Belsen concentration camp, which was an appalling, appalling scene that they faced there. And it was still manned by SS guards who had killed thousands. Now, this was a moment when you would expect the SAS to wreak instant retaliation against the SS murderers. On the contrary, they did not do so. They simply rounded them up and sent them off for trial. And writing the book, I felt that was a signal moment of civilization in an otherwise brutal and horrific war.
Yeah, you describe in the book how the SAS just kind of walk into the camp and the guards are just kind of looking at them and they don't really do anything.
The guards are not only just looking at them, not doing anything. I mean, the guards are continuing business as usual, and there's a horrific incident. We mentioned Fraser McCluskey earlier, when the guards simply start systematically beating up one of the prisoners, and one of the SAS, well, a particularly tough character, stepped forward and asked for permission to teach the guard a lesson, which probably would have meant shooting him in the head. In fact, he just knocked him down.
Knocked him out, right. Well, we need to take one more break. Coming up, more on how the British SAS changed the nature of war. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Poetry. Poet Eva Kruschill writes in her most recent collection about the history of American immigration.
And I think it's funny that history repeats itself, and that as soon as we get legalized, we tend to distance ourselves from those people who are not legalized yet, but they have something to tell us.
This week on The Bookshelf from NHPR, Eva Kruschill on poetry and immigration. Subscribe to The Bookshelf from NHPR wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, Ben McIntyre, author of Rogue Heroes, about the origins of the SAS. And the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send emails to exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange and give us your questions about World War II. Ben, another kind of big theme that I think is important to note is the importance of language skills and how this kind of reflects the for me, the surprisingly kind of multinational flavor of these units. I mean, you do have these amazing stories in the book about, you know, various unit members impersonating Germans and Italians. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with sort of where they recruit people and kind of the fact that there are all sorts of different nationalities represented in this unit.
That's exactly right. I mean, there were Americans, Canadians, French, Jewish, I mean, not a nationality, but, you know, Czech, yep. Romanian, German. I mean, one of the things that Sterling did was very deliberately to set out, almost as if he was recruiting a kind of dirty dozen, really, to get a whole sort of set of different, often rather conflicting types of character. I mean, the one thing that sort of drew them together, really, I think, this unit, was that they were unconventional soldiers. And so he really did want people who were, and this applies to sort of latter-day special forces recruitment as well, he wanted people who could think laterally. He wanted people who had a sort of expansive, not a sort of simply obedient approach to military operations. And language skills was absolutely part of that. And there was a lot, I mean, one particular segment of this sort of special forces world was called the Special Interrogation Unit. In fact, that was a completely made up name. These were Palestinian, German speaking Palestinian Jews, German Jews who were recruited to impersonate German soldiers and would simply climb into trucks and drive deep into enemy territory posing as German soldiers in order to carry out yet more sabotage missions. I mean, the level of bravery required to do that almost defies description, really.
It's interesting. It seems to me as the story switches to the European theater and you follow these units up through Italy and into France and Germany, it almost seems a little, and in particular in preparation for D-Day, it seems almost a little bit like they're victims of their own success. The unit grows dramatically, I think up to something like 2,500 people, and you sense some consternation from the SAS commanders that bigger is not necessarily better. And just sort of, as you mentioned, I think early in the show, it's harder to hide, 100 people in the woods than it is to hide 10 or 15. And this actually, that and I think a change in their mission from being dropped behind enemy lines to kind of being out in front of the advancing forces. So can you say a little bit about some of those changes? And also, I think the topography factors into this as well.
It absolutely does. I mean, you put your finger on a very good point. I mean, just to reiterate, the point of the SAS was to send tiny units of men, sometimes usually five men in total, to attack specific high-value strategic targets. That's what was. It wasn't to be used for tactical operations, i.e., you know, for individual attempts to change the nature, the sort of shape of the front line. That's not what the SAS was invented for. It was there to try and alter the strategy of war, i.e. to affect the progress of war at a much more elevated and overall, they wanted to change the shape of the battlefield. Now, that's very hard to do with large numbers of men. I mean, the point of it is secrecy, mobility, stealth, ingenuity, intelligence and guile, and that's hard to do if you've got a large number of people. And as you say, certainly in the middle part of the war, particularly during the liberation of Italy, the SAS was being used as assault troops. They were effectively being used as high-grade combat commandos. Now, they were very good at that, but that isn't why they were invented. And I think the penny dropped really about halfway through the Italian campaign when the SAS was losing an enormous amount of men because they were being used for these sort of head-on attacks. And they finally realized that actually it was much better to use them in small sort of you know, tactical operations. And so in the run-up to D-Day, they were specifically used really to delay the advance of the panzer divisions coming north to try to repel the Normandy invasion. And they were spectacularly successful. But as you say, they were in large numbers, and many were captured and many were killed.
Well, you read in the book, there's almost sort of a nostalgia from some of these more veteran members of the units that they just can't disappear into the desert anymore.
That's right. I think there is a feeling that somehow the embracing anonymity of the desert had gone, and it was replaced by something much more difficult to manage, which was, you know, they were having to cooperate with local resistance groups, some of whom were heavily penetrated by German and Nazi intelligence. So they were having to deal with pretty fickle friends in some cases, and that led another different sort of colour to the battlefield. It wasn't as straightforward as before, and it was considerably more bloody.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones, and Tom is joining us from Wyndham. Tom, welcome to The Exchange.
Really good program, thank you. I'm curious, you know, for this non-veteran to watch a movie with Special Forces, it always seems like it's just as hard, if not harder, to get the people out after they've gone in to do an operation as it is to get in and do the operation. What were the priorities for the SAS like about getting their people out? What were casualties like?
That's an excellent question, Tom. I know, Ben, in the book you mentioned that some of the early missions, they just kind of have to leave people behind, which is sort of not what you typically hear about the more sort of modern Special Forces ethos.
No, that's a great question, Tom. I mean, the truth is, at the beginning of the SAS's life, getting them out was considered much less important than getting them in, to a degree that I found as a modern reader really quite hard to stomach.
That's true. I had the same reaction. You know, just sort of, you know, here's a gun, here's some water, good luck.
Good luck, off you go. And these guys are also heartbreakingly young. Yeah. That, bear that in mind. I mean, the average age of an SAS trooper in 1941 was about 21 years old. I mean, they were really young. So they were doing what they were told. And there was a level, to me, even for the time, there was a level of irresponsibility about the early SAS command that I find still very hard to take. It seemed to me that particularly the first operation, Operation Squatter, which was this attempt, it was the inaugural attempt of the SAS, really should not have been allowed to take place. The weather forecast was atrocious. They knew that the worst storm in 30 years was coming. And yet they went ahead with it. I mean, Stirling always maintained afterwards that if he hadn't gone ahead with that operation, there would never have been an SAS because it would have been disbanded. But it was an unmitigated catastrophe. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of them were scraped to death on the desert floor because they couldn't unclip their parachutes in time. Others were so badly injured that, as Dean says, they had to be left to die of thirst in the desert. Now, I don't think you should ever mount an operation that is so, you know, if the target was hugely valuable, then maybe yes, but in that circumstance it didn't seem to me that the rewards, and there were almost zero rewards from Operation Squatter, merited that kind of neglect.
Now, I mentioned the growth of the SAS, and it sort of, in some sense, is driven by its success. But there's this sort of very interesting vignette in the book about a connection with Winston Churchill's son Randolph, which in part gives the founder David Stirling really access to Churchill and the ability to kind of plead his case for a bigger organization in which he would have more control.
Yes, I mean, the role played by Randolph Churchill, who was Churchill's son, is completely forgotten. And it's an odd thing to reflect on. I mean, Randolph was a most unlikely Special Forces soldier. I mean, for one thing, he was tremendously overweight. He was also quite often drunk. And he was a sort of jobbing journalist, really. I mean, he was quite good company, but he wasn't a very good soldier. But Stirling recruited him because he realized in a slightly cynical way that if young Churchill got interested in the SAS project, he would quite likely tell his father about it. And that is exactly what happened. Randolph took part in another operation, a raid on Benghazi, which was, again, a complete disaster, in fact. I mean, it didn't work at all. It went completely wrong. The idea was that they would drive into Benghazi, then paddle out secretly to the shipping moored in the harbour and blow it up to block the harbour, and then simply run away at the end of it. I mean, in some ways, hilariously, it went completely wrong. They couldn't even inflate the boats that they brought to go and do it. So there was a level of incompetence in all of this. But Randolph Churchill wrote a rather wonderful, very colourful account of what had happened to his father back in London. And this piqued Churchill's imagination. He began to become very interested in what Stirling and the SAS was doing out in the desert. And in fact, he and Stirling met in Cairo when Churchill was on his way to meet Stalin. And they got on famously well. And from that moment, really, the future of the SAS was assured. So there's some irony here, really. The idea that, you know, the most elite forces in the world, Delta Force, SEALs, the SAS, would probably never have come into being had it not been for the intervention of a rather fat, drunk journalist called Randolph Churchill.
Well, and you also mentioned kind of in conjunction with this that I found fascinating was that there is kind of a romanticization, kind of a romanticizing of what they do. They you know, during the war itself, they've already become kind of this legendary secret force that really almost kind of provides a morale boost for, you know, regular soldiers, politicians, British citizens, etc.
Oh, it undoubtedly does. I mean, bear in mind that a lot of these soldiers in 1941 had at the back of their minds the stories of Lawrence of Arabia. So the idea of a kind of swashbuckling figure who was able to operate in the sands of the desert was already deeply implanted in popular culture. And so they were kind of, in a way, starting from that accepted mythology. But they played up to it wonderfully. I mean, the SAS deliberately clad themselves in these sort of turbans with kind of big bushy beards and carrying bandoliers and kind of, you know, any kind of guns. They look like a bunch of sea pirates, which is exactly what they are. And one of the things that I discovered in the archive is that there are thousands of photographs. One of the things that the SAS was very good at was taking photographs of each other. And you almost get a sense that they they realised that the sort of, in a way, the public relations aspect of what they were doing was going to be very, very important in later life, that people wanted to see them. They wanted to see these kind of roguish, tough private armies operating highly successfully in the desert. And a kind of mythology began to build up around these sort of swashbuckling figures that David Stirling himself sort of developed the sort of sobriquet, the Phantom Major, they used to call him. Well, he used to pretend that he was rather embarrassed by this title. In fact, he absolutely loved it. He was thrilled to be known as the Phantom Major.
It's interesting, you know, you mentioned this sort of legend building up around that, and I think you mentioned this early in the show, and in looking, there are some amazing pictures in this book, just how young they all were. It was just remarkable to me. I mean, we were really talking about the sort of senior people in the units being, late 20s maybe early 30s, something like that. But a lot of them are really sort of early 20s.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they are, you know, Stirling himself is not even 30 by the time the war ends. So, you know, these are very, very young men. And I think that is no accident. You don't, you know, sensible, more mature people don't agree to do this sort of stuff because it is incredibly dangerous. But there's something really poignant about just how young they are. And one or two of them, I mean, there's a particular man called Johnny Cooper, whose story is extraordinary, really, because he lied his way into the SAS by pretending he was 20 when in fact he was barely 17.
Was there a draft? Would you get drafted into the regular army like we had here?
Yeah, eventually. Yeah absolutely. You know, but no, these guys were volunteers, bear in mind. I mean, you had to volunteer.
But I mean, to get into the military, you drafted and then you were volunteering for this.
Yeah, for you, definitely volunteering for this. And I think I'm right in saying that initially volunteering for the army as well. So, you know, they weren't conscripts. These weren't people
forced
into.
Right, that's what I was wondering,
They weren't forced into there at all. No, I mean, you really had to volunteer for the SAS. And you had to have a particular cast of mind, too. They did not want. I mean, Stirling was very specific and very, very exact about the sorts of people that he wanted in his unit. He did not want people who were psychopaths. Although he got a few, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, people who of that type of mind are sometimes attracted to this kind of warfare. That's the way that comes with the territory. But on the whole, he wanted people who were highly intelligent, tough as blazes, but bright enough to be able to carry it off. And that still holds today.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that you're a little constrained about what you can discuss about modern SAS activities. For security reasons, obviously, but can you just say a little bit about sort of broadly kind of the legacy of this whole experience for Special Forces?
Well, there's absolutely no doubt that the SAS was the inspiration for Delta Force. I mean, it was a particular officer who was seconded to the SAS.
Beckwith?
That's right. Who used the SAS as the model for Delta Force. So there's a very direct link there, and SAS forces around the world. There was a statement the other day by the US Defense Secretary in which he described, and I'm paraphrasing here, what the impact of special forces might be on ISIS or similar organizations. And he said, we want them never to know who is coming through the window in the middle of the night. Now, that to me is a perfect description of exactly what David Sterling and the SAS had in mind when they founded the SAS 75 years ago in the desert. It's keep the enemy off kilter the whole time, make sure they don't know what's coming where, keep changing the rules, make sure that the asymmetrical nature of that kind of warfare works in your favor. And that, although the techniques and the technology have changed, that has not changed.
Mm-hmm. Now, for people who are interested in, obviously we've mentioned your book, Rogue Heroes, but you've also made a three-part documentary on this book for the BBC called Rogue Warriors. And there are about six or eight clips from the series. It looks fascinating. I'm not sure if we can watch that here in the U.S. yet, but I'm interested to hear a little bit about that documentary project.
Well, to answer your question, it will become available in the U.S. before too long, I hope. Mm-hmm. That was extraordinary. I mean, that involved going back to all the places where the SAS had fought their war. And my goodness, I got a sense of just how brutal and tough and resilient you had to be to do this kind of warfare. I mean, the North African desert is not an easy place to live, but it's a very easy place to die. And fighting war there holds, you know, I mean, even for a journalist, I mean, you know, like me, with lots of sort of spare water around the place and an air-conditioned truck not too far away, it was pretty tough sledding. I mean, I found it physically very demanding. The idea of doing that with virtually no water for months on end, I mean, that was
pretty
horrendous.
Remarkable. Yeah.
Pretty remarkable stuff.
My final question for you, and I'm sure you probably get asked this, I'm curious, has anybody optioned this book for a screenplay? It would make quite a quite an adventure movie.
Funny you should say that. It has, in fact, just been optioned.
There you go.
There you go. To make, well, in fact, rather imaginatively, the company that's bought it wants to make a sort of multi-part television drama. Wants to do a sort of, as it were, a Band of Brothers.
Sure.
But for the North African campaign, which will be wonderful if it happens.
Great. Well, we'll look forward to that. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I'd like to thank Ben for a very interesting and enjoyable conversation. Ben, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
A huge pleasure. Thank you very much.
That's Ben McIntyre, author of Rogue Heroes, The History of the SAS, Britain's secret special forces unit that sabotaged the Nazis and changed the nature of war. He also writes for The Times of London and has made documentaries of his work for the BBC. He joined us from London. And remember, the conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.